Well, this year the Ride at Home event has a couple of events that we're celebrating in particular. The first being this is the 100th anniversary of the death of the Bishop Milton Wright, who was Wilbur Norville's father. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about him this year. We also are going to have a special guest, and that's a 1932 Essex Terraplane, which was a car that Orville was well documented as having owned. And his particular Terraplane was the first one off of the production line, and it was dedicated with a bottle of gasoline being broken over the radiator by Amelia Earhart, of all things. As far as we know, Orville wasn't at that ceremony, but Amelia was there to christen that first Essex that Orville later on drove. We're not going to have that actual car here, I want to caution people, but we are going to have a 32 Terraplane just like he had. That was a pretty innovative car for its day. It was a middle class, it was kind of a working man's car, but it was well known as being a very well-built car. It also had a rather large engine for its size. One of the striking things about it is it's much smaller than the cars you might be used to from the period, and it ended up being a very successful model and made a lot of money for Hudson.
That'll be on display to kind of add to the context of the time period.
That'll be on display right here at the house. Orville, as you probably know, had a very large three-car garage, and he loved cars. He liked to tinker on them, and he liked to drive them very fast as well. He has a reputation of being quite a speed merchant, and there are actually stories of the police officers here in Oakwood and Dayton sort of turning their heads when Orville Wright went by so that they didn't have to give him a ticket for speeding. He was known for that.
Let's talk about Milton as patriarch of the family and his relationship with this house.
Well, Milton was born, as was his wife, Susan Corner Wright. They were born in eastern Indiana in the mid-1800s. The land that they were living on had just in recent history been Indian territory, to kind of put it in perspective. Milton grew up, in a cabin out in the country, out in the sticks. One day he was, as the story goes, he was clearing stumps from a field to be sown into crops. And as he did that, he had an epiphany. He was called by God to serve him. And as a result, he became a minister in the Church of the Brethren and later on rose to the position of bishop in the Church of the Brethren, and spent his entire life traveling to visit different flocks around the country, many of them here, right here in the region. As a result, Susan Corner Wright was left at home to raise her young family quite often. About 6 months out of the year, she was alone and was left to fend for herself, to take care of their house and do all the handiwork around the house, execute all the repairs, which Milton didn't really care to do himself. But she was well suited to it because she had grown up on a farm where her father had a carriage making operation and also built fine buggies and wagons. So she was well schooled in the use of woodworking tools and probably had a little skill at working metal as well. And she taught her young sons, Wilbur and Orville, and as well as Lauren and Ruchlin, to use those tools when they were quite young to help her out.
And at what point was this house built?
The house we're standing in, Hawthorne Hill, was built in 1912, and it's really a result of the new wealth that Wilbur and Orville Wright came upon as a result of the invention of the flying machine. They had about $250,000 in the bank when they set aside time to design and have this house built. The architects were Skank and Skank, and we really don't know where their inspiration came from exactly as to the style of the house, but the type of architecture that it's built, it's a classic Greek architecture, which was popular and always has been popular for its just simple beauty. One of the reasons they built the house was just a matter of practicality. As you can imagine, once they became known as aviators, a lot of people came to town to visit them to discuss business matters. In the early days, they came to just really discover whether or not Wilbur and Orville Wright were all they said they were. They didn't really know. Not too many people had seen them fly. So they wanted to check them out to find out if they were the real deal. And Wilbur and Orville would have to pay for hotel rooms to put these people up here in Dayton when they visited over the course of a few days. They would often entertain them at their family dinner table at number 7 Hawthorne Street, which was a very small house. So this house was built a bit sort of as a practical matter so that they could accommodate important guests here in town who came to see them.
And we're sitting high up on a hill in Oakwood. Right now we're standing in the rather large entryway to the house. Was there a particular reason this spot was chosen to build the house on?
Well, you know, as luck would have it, the 1913 flood came around just right as the house was being built. So it was really a lucky circumstance that they did build a house here. As you can imagine, they were living in West Dayton, which at the time was most likely a floodplain. It sat right next to the river. Wolf Creek and the Great Miami River were running right along its borders. So I'm assuming that in the course of their lives as young men and even as children, that there was water in their cellar or that there was minor flooding during those periods of time, and they just wanted to have a house that was on high ground. They scouted out a piece of property and actually bought a piece of property out Salem Avenue. Catherine still wasn't quite happy with it. She'd heard about this up-and-coming little community of Oakwood and wanted them to investigate property over here, so they came over, checked out this piece of property, and obviously it was attractive to them, so they bought it. It was about a 13-acre tract to begin with.
Do you know how long it took to build the house?
It took about 2.5 years, I believe. They moved in I think, April of 1914. There's a great photograph here of the house. Let me dig this out, and I'll, there's a lot to be interpreted from this photograph. For one thing, you can see this is right after they'd moved in, or just prior to. The house has no curtains in the windows. There's a little sign up here, images of such good quality, you can enlarge this, and it says, "Please stay away." And if you come in even closer, you can see that the limestone steps that you came up to walk inside the house are not there yet. There are board steps placed in front of the house, so it wasn't quite done yet, just like a lot of houses nowadays that people move into. They didn't have a garage yet. That was built later on in the spring and summer. The house, when they first moved in, and we know this from the bishop's diaries, that's one of the great things about Bishop Milton Wright. He kept a diary for about 60 years and just wrote down little everyday details in that diary on a daily basis. He noted that they didn't have any gas in the house yet, so that they had to spend the first night without any heat in the house, and they didn't have any electricity either. And he said, tomorrow morning, DP&L is going to come out and hook up the gas and electricity. And sure enough, in his diary, the next day, we know that they came out and did that. So that first night was a little bit like camping for them. When the house was being built, of course, it came under construction just a few months after Wilbur's untimely death. At the same time, the same month that Wilbur was languishing in bed, it just so happened that Orville's car arrived. He had just ordered his first car. It was an air-cooled Franklin runabout, and you can see it sitting right here in front of the house. In order to, relieve the stress of his death, they used to take long drives into the country, and the bishop used to write about that in his diary, about going down the Centerville Pike to the Miamisburg Pike to the Farmersville Pike and so forth and so on. He wrote about all these different little car trips they would take in the evenings. On one occasion, they came over here to the house. Of course, like any new homeowner would, they wanted to check on the progress of the construction. And he noted that the brick was up on the house about a third of the way up. And they went up onto the roof on the Widow's Walk, which is kind of a famous attraction for people here who come to visit. They went up onto that Widow's Walk, and they had a picnic dinner that night. So those are some of the notes that we've gleaned from his diary.
And where is that diary today?
Actual diary is probably at Wright State.
There's a series of smaller like diaries, and they're all at Wright State University, and they have actually transcribed all of the handwritten entries into a text document. It's actually a book that's, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 inches thick, and it's just page after page, day after day of what was going on. But one thing I would just add is I think it's interesting that Milton Wright was 82 years old when he moved in here, so many of the family letters speak to... I take that back. Milton Wright was 85 years old when he moved into this house, and so he, like a lot of people with aging parents, Catherine would write to her eventual husband, Harry Haskell, about being concerned about their dad tripping on rugs and things like that, you know, making sure that there were no trip hazards, fall hazards in the home. So it was still a family home, Hawthorne Hill, in many respects. And the other interesting thing with Milton Wright is that he did, in fact, get to fly on an airplane, which I think is really pretty notable. This man that, as Steve points out, grew up in a time when the area where he grew up was being cleared for Native Americans farther west. You know, he's 82 years old when he flies on an airplane. And not knowing how his 82-year-old father would react to the experience. Orville was flying somewhat closer to the ground than he would have otherwise, a little conservatively. And they say over the noise of the engine and the spinning propellers, Milton just kept saying, "Higher, Orv, higher." So he got a real kick out of that experience.
This is an annual event, and each year there's a little something new with the house. Tell me what some of the work that's been done in the past year.
So we view Wright at Home as an opportunity to be a fundraiser for our organization and the Oakwood Historical Society, and as an opportunity to create new memories for people, to be able to go through the house so that they have a stake in the house and its history. Because being a house that's over a century old, like anyone who's ever owned an old house, there are constantly issues that need attention, paint that has to be scraped and sanded and repainted, areas that need to be repaired. And so during the past year, we've had several areas in the house, including the ceiling of Orville Wright's bathroom and the ceiling of his shower, that have been repainted. We've had other areas on the first floor where we've had plaster repair that had been previously damaged. We've had that repaired and repainted. We've also stripped the paint off of the original outlet covers for the outlets for the central vacuum system that's in the house. And I will say something that many communities, many private property owners, many cities have been dealing with is the scourge of the emerald ash borer. And here at Hawthorne Hill, we had to take out 7 beautiful old ash trees on the property. So we're working now on a revised landscape plan for the property so that we can continue to have it be a showcase for the community now and into the future, both the physical building and the grounds. So that's a real challenge to lose 7 of those old growth ash trees. And 2, on the north side of the house, well over 100 years old, and we have film footage from the 1930s where you see those trees in the film footage, and they were already large, grand-looking trees. So that was a particular loss for us during the last year. But again, looking ahead, we really think there's some bright days ahead for the house.
So we're standing in the Bishop Milton Wright's bedroom. He passed away in 1916, so he only lived here for a couple of years in this brand new house that his sons had built. The room, as you can see, is not any particular large size. It was actually a little bit bigger in Milton's day. When the NCR Corporation took the house over in the late 40s, they added a bathroom to the room, so they took a little bit of the initial floor space that this room had. They also changed the doorway to the room. The original doorway is just down the hall, and it's sealed, and it would now, if you could enter it today, it would enter into what is now a closet, and then there's also a small bathroom as well. The Bishop's room is a bit of a mystery because NCR Corporation, for whatever reason, documented the house photographically before they took it over to, so that we knew what kind of furnishings were in the house, what kind of wall coverings and all that sort of thing. For some reason, there are no photos that we know of that exist of the Bishop's room, so we really don't know what his room looked like in those days. The Bishop spent his last years here at the house just very quietly. He took long naps. There are photos of him sitting in rocking chairs, you know, dozing off. He was probably reading the Bible, his favorite book, and he did have occasion to take a trip with Orville and Catherine up to Canada, to Georgian Bay in 1915. They all went up there to get away and have a little break from the action here in Dayton. Orville was recovering from a very serious bout of illness in the winter of 1915, in which he was bedridden. He was had an attack of sciatica and was in a lot of pain as a result of his back injury and just generally run down. So they went up to Georgian Bay to spend time up there on vacation, and the Bishop went with them. They stayed in a cabin on Wabeck Island. They were hosted by a Canadian family, and they had to head back a little early because there was going to be a railroad strike, so they decided to head back to avoid any issues with being able to travel back once that strike had started. And so they came back to Dayton, but before they left, Orville had fallen in love with Georgian Bay, and he bought an 8-acre island up there where he and Catherine enjoyed spending much of the rest of their lives in the summertime just whiling away the hours. It was a place where they could go, and nobody really cared who they were. They could just be themselves and just really enjoy the very relaxing and atmosphere and beauty of Georgian Bay. You can see we have a few photos here of the Bishop in his later years. There's this great photo of the family out on the lawn here at Hawthorne Hill. My great uncle Horace Wright, who I knew quite well growing up, he was the youngest of Lauren's children. He spent a lot of time with his grandfather and his aunt and uncle, Orville and Catherine. He being the youngest member of my great-grandfather's children, sort of suffered a little bit from neglect. He was the fourth child, so he didn't get as much attention, Orville and Catherine felt, as some of the older children, as his older siblings did. So Orville and Catherine undertook to sort of take my uncle Horace under their wing, and he spent a lot of time with them over the years. So in his later years, when he was just a, when he was an early teen, he was spending a lot of time with his aunt and uncle Orville and Catherine here at the house. On one occasion, he came to the house to visit, and they asked him if he wanted to accompany them to the train station to pick up Mr. Bernard, who was coming in. They went down to the train station, and to his surprise, they picked up a St. Bernard puppy in a crate who was named Scipio, and that was Orville and Catherine's companion for the next 5 years. He was inseparable from them. We also have photos in the room of, this is my great-uncle, great-granduncle Ruchlin Wright. He was the oldest of the family. Some people call him the black sheep. He moved away very early on when he was a young man and really wasn't here in Dayton to witness all of the things that his younger brothers went on to do, but did come back on occasion to visit. And when he did, of course, he was welcomed here to the house. Orville always had an open invitation to all the family members to come and visit him. He was very close to his family and really appreciated their visits.
So we know a lot about the Wright family, educated, innovative entrepreneurs. Do we know specifics about the philosophy that Milton Wright had about family life and the way he wanted them raised or the way he raised them?
Well, their family was very tightly knit. It's been hypothesized that because the bishop and his wife grew up on the frontier, that keeping the family close to home was sort of just an instinctive protective measure that they exercised over their family. So as we all know now, they were a very tightly knit family. Wilbur and Orville and Catherine were still living in their father's house, you know, well into middle age until they built this house. So they stuck together. The bishop, of course, obviously was a man of very deep religious conviction, yet he didn't let that stand in the way of assimilating new knowledge. I mean, he had a library that was not just all about religion. He had books of all types in his library, books on natural science. He had Darwin's Origin of Species, which would have been absolutely the antithesis, I think, of the way he actually thought life was played out. But he wasn't afraid of either gaining new knowledge himself or allowing his family to read whatever they felt they were interested in to read. He was obviously a man of deep religious convictions. He didn't hold his family to that, however. He required his family to go to church every Sunday with him until they were 18 years old, and then they were free to make the decision as to whether they wanted to follow the teachings of the church themselves, or they could choose whatever religion they wanted if they were predisposed to do that. Wilbur and Orville, even after the bishop's death, would neither fly or work on Sundays out of respect for their father. And that was absolutely perplexing to a lot of people who couldn't understand why, when there was a large crowd gathered, why Wilbur and Orville Wright wouldn't take off in their airplane. But they were doing that out of respect for their father.
And if I could just add to that, they also set up an exhibition flying team, and the biggest races with the biggest prizes and purses to be awarded always took place on Sundays, and much to the chagrin of these pilots, Wilbur and Orville would not permit their exhibition flyers, their stunt pilots, to fly on Sundays, out of respect, again, for, you know, respecting Sunday. But I think it's also interesting at the same time that from the time they are adults on their own until the end of their lives, neither of them ever attended church regularly. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing. It's also interesting, based on what Steve was mentioning a moment ago, is that, you know, the bishop was very traditional and very religious in many respects, but he was also forward-thinking with some issues. For example, he actually marched with his daughter Catherine in a suffragette parade through downtown Dayton. And he commented in his diary that he thought that he was probably the oldest person in that parade. So I think he's a fascinating figure from that standpoint.
Yeah. My grandfather, when he was a teenager, traveled with the bishop as he visited his flock for a period of time one summer. They were gone, he said, for 21 days. Typically, they would arrive at the church of a congregation, and his grandfather would preach a sermon, and then somebody would load them in a wagon or a buggy and take them down the road to the next congregation where he would preach another sermon. I assume the next day, after having spent the night at someone's house, he would preach another sermon. My grandfather, the most notable thing that he took away from that that experience was that in 21 days, he was served 22 chicken and dumpling dinners, and he thought he was going to grow feathers.
That's great.
That's great. I never heard that.
Yeah. One of the most significant acts that Bishop Milton Wright perpetrated on his young sons was that when he was, as you know, he spent a lot of time on the road traveling, and he would always bring home maybe little trinkets or gifts for them on occasion, as well as an arm full of periodicals or books that he'd collected on his trip just to pass the time away. So he was stuffing his house with books and literature for his young sons to absorb. But on one occasion, he brought home a toy called a Panade helicopter. Monsieur Panade was a Frenchman who had patented the idea of powering a toy with a twisted rubber band. He was the guy who got all that started. And he'd patented this small helicopter toy that used feathers for the rotors and was made out of balsa wood, very lightweight. The bishop came home one night, as the story goes, and he was concealing this wound-up helicopter in his hands. And he released it, and it flew up around the ceiling until the rubber band power, of course, ran out, and it fell to the floor. And then Wilbur and Orville spent the next several days playing with the toy until they broke it. They actually wore it out. So the bishop, in some ways, was instrumental in inspiring his young sons to explore the problem of flight much later in life. That was the first event that they actually noted that piqued their interest on the subject of powered flight.